Hey, Chris.
Hi, Ross. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine.
I think under the new improved Blogging Hits dispensation, we're supposed to introduce ourselves. So I'm Ross Douthat. I am a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly, a part-time blogger, and for the purposes of this discussion, the film critic for National Review. And I'm here with Chris, who is...
My name is Chris Orr. I'm a senior editor at the New Republic and writing mostly about film these days.
So, as you can probably tell, we're here to talk about the movies. And I guess earlier this month or before the holiday season, Chris had a very interesting dialogue with Dana Stevens, who's the film critic for Slate, about politics and the movies, and particularly the spate of Iraq War-related films that came out earlier this year. And we're here sort of to pick up where Chris and Dana left off with the holiday releases, but maybe branch out from the discussion of politics in the movies just into a discussion of movies more generally.
Especially as you skipped all the war movies very wisely.
Well, I did. Whereas Chris has a film critic's job where he reviews almost every movie that comes out, National Review only comes out every 2 weeks, so I only have to pick a movie to see every 2 weeks, which means that I avoided having to review and write about Rendition, for instance.
Yes, I think this whole wedding thing was really just an excuse to get out of seeing Redacted.
It's possible. Don't tell my wife, though. So why don't we kick things off by talking about Juno, which is the sleeper hit of the Christmas season, and deservedly so, I think. It's made like $60 million so far, which is really impressive. And it's a kind of a culture war movie, in the sense that it's about a lot of hot button issues, you know, teen pregnancy, abortion, adoption, and so on. And so what did you think of Juno, Chris?
Like you, I thought it was terrific. I thought it was a great movie, very funny, and in addition to being very funny, very humane. I wouldn't really call it a culture war movie. It certainly hits on some of those topics, but in a way that manages, I think, to deflate a lot of the tensions rather than heighten them, which I think is probably something you'd agree with as well.
Yeah, well, Anne Hulbert wrote, I thought, a pretty good piece for Slate about just that phenomenon, talking about, you know, why one of the reasons Juno is successful as a work of art, and maybe one of the reasons a lot of the more pointedly political movies earlier this year weren't, was that it deliberately avoids stereotyping. Every time it raises a stereotype, it immediately complicates that stereotype. It avoids, you know, preaching to one choir or another, and so, you know, it feels like a story about real life rather than real life as filtered through, say, Robert Redford's real worldview. Although it is real life as filtered through Diablo Cody's vision as the screenwriter, her vision of how young people talk these days.
Yes, which I think is notable for things other than authenticity.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, we talked about this before, but I did think after the first, you know, 10 to 15 minutes of the movie, I was actually kind of worried that the whole sort of hipper-than-thou dialogue that she'd written for the characters would end up ringing hollow as the movie went along. I thought some of the opening scenes, particularly the movie starts with Juno McGuff, who's this newly pregnant, is she 15 years old?
16, I think.
Yeah, going to a convenience store where Rainn Wilson, who plays Dwight on The Office, is the guy behind the counter, and they have this whole sort of weirdly bantering
exchange.
Your echo
is Prego, Fertile Myrtle.
This right, and she says, silencio, old man, while she's looking at her pregnancy test and so on.
And this is after a credit sequence, too, that could hardly declare the indie aspirations of the movie more vividly, and it did seem at the very beginning, I like you, was a little nervous. It was just going to be too coy for its own good. It had that sort of semi animated opening. I can't remember the music it was set to, but set to some indie tune, and it did seem very, very distant from any kind of lived life in those early scenes.
Yeah, but I thought it came. I mean, unlike you, I think I thought that went on a little longer than just the opening scene. I thought some of the stuff, like where she's, you know, she calls the abortion clinic on her, is it a hamburger phone?
Hamburger phone,
it's
yes.
A hamburger phone. I mean, there are just things like that seemed like they were, you know, they seemed like a better idea on the printed page than on screen. But
right.
I think as, you know, the movie went on and deepened and became more serious, this sort of the style of dialogue became less jarring, funnier, and the movie as a whole became really good. And I should note actually right here for our audience that we're going to try and avoid it, but we'll probably let some spoilers slip in the course of these conversations. So if you haven't seen the movie in question, I guess you should tread carefully while you're watching it. So we apologize in advance.
Good. So obviously Juno does turn out to be pregnant, and after briefly flirting with the idea of having an abortion, or more than flirting, she goes to a clinic with the intention of having an abortion, but at the clinic decides that she does not want to. And I know you have some thoughts on this, Ross. And what do you think the scene at the clinic tells us?
There's been a whole discussion in the blogs. Dana Stevens again at Slate talked about this, about sort of whether a lot of people have compared Knocked Up to Juno, since they're both movies about unwed mothers who consider having an abortion but ultimately decide to keep the baby. And so there's been a lot of talk about whether these movies have politics. Some people are saying that it's a sign that Hollywood is sort of trying to either cater to pro-lifers or just sort of sidestep the realities of abortion.
I think we may disagree on some details. I think we both agree that that's a pretty silly and facile reading, and that none of these movies are particularly engineered to appeal to a traditionalist crowd. Certainly not Juno.
Not Juno. And I mean, Knocked Up is... Well, I think that there's a sense in which Judd Apatow, with Knocked Up, and before that, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, is doing a kind of, you could call it like socially conservative raunch.
I think there is
sort of a subversively like pro-virginity message in The 40-Year-Old Virgin, and then, I think that both Knocked Up and Juno have an implicit, it's not a politically pro-life message in the sense that like these are not briefs for overturning Roe v. Wade or instituting penalties for abortion, but both movies are pretty clearly pro-life in the broader sense that whatever the politics of the screenwriter or director, the way they handle abortion treats abortion as a very bad thing to do.
Well, here's where we can start disagreeing.
Good.
I agree with you largely on Knocked Up. I would not go so far as to say that Juno treats abortion as a very bad thing to do. I think it does treat abortion as sort of an unfortunate thing to do, and it clearly says, as I think you're conveying basically, that given a reasonable choice between having an abortion and not having an abortion, it's better not to have an abortion. Where I guess I disagree with you is that I think all of these movies, again, Apatow the least, and the third, which we haven't really talked about, is Waitress, which, to my mind, was much more notable for how pro-adultery it was than for how anti-abortion. Not a movie that I imagine social conservatives would appreciate a great deal at all. But in all three cases, again, Apatow the least, I think they clearly think that the woman ought to have this choice. The woman makes the choice to keep the baby, I think that the movies applaud, but I don't think there's any sense in which these movies think that the woman should not have the opportunity to make that choice herself. I don't think any of these movies think that, certainly not Juno least of the bunch, that Juno, the almost anarchic, nonconformist, should be told by adults that she has to bear this child. I mean, she partly bears the child as an act of rebellion herself against a society where it would almost be anticipated that what she would do is have the abortion. But I think the idea that any of these films are pro-life in the literal sense of thinking that Roe v. Wade should be overturned or abortion should be extremely difficult to procure, I just don't think that's true. You can say they're anti-abortion, and we may disagree to some extent about how anti-abortion they are. I would say
they're anti-abortion in the sense that to varying degrees they present abortion as an immoral act. Which I agree is not at all the same thing as being pro-life in the political sense. And I agree that Apatow's movie, that Knocked Up, goes further down this road than Juno. I think what's
no
striking
question.
About Knocked Up is the sense in which abortion is presented, one, as much less of a plausible option than in Juno. I mean, she doesn't even get as far, Catherine Hagel's character doesn't even get as far as the abortion clinic. She never really seems to consider it. And the two characters who are pushing for it are her mother, on the one hand, who is sort of a picture
repulsive,
brittle WASP entitlement, who tells her, you know, you need to have the abortion because that way someday you can have a real baby. And it's this line where, you know, clearly the audience is meant to sort of boo and hiss. And then on the other hand, you have the main character, Seth Rogen.
Although it is interesting that even though Juno chooses to have the baby, there's a very similar line at the end of Juno, where Juno's father, she's just had the baby. She's just delivered the baby. She's giving it up for adoption. And her father basically, you know, pats her and says, you'll be back here again someday. You know, with the implication that it's not that this baby is unreal, but it's unreal for her. It's not her baby.
Right, but I think that there's a difference between the way the language that's used in Knocked Up is the language of what you're carrying is not a real baby in the sense of being a baby.
I think it's a little open interpretation, but I wouldn't really dispute that.
Okay. And the other sort of pro-abortion character in Knocked Up is Jonah Hill's character, who, you know, and there's the whole scene where they talk about, they don't even want to say the word, they want to call it a smash-mortion.
Smash-mortion, yeah.
And then Juno, I agree, goes much further in this sort of pro-choice direction. On the other hand, the crucial turning point, insofar as there is one, in Juno's decision not to have the abortion is, you know, she goes to the abortion clinic and she encounters her Asian, sort of heavily accented, slightly ridiculous classmate protesting outside and, you know, with a placard saying, all babies want to be borned, I think.
Right.
Or maybe that's what she's chanting. But it's
something
like...
That's what she's
chanting. Right, it's something, you know, slightly ridiculous sounding. But as Juno is going into the clinic, her classmate calls after, you know, your baby already has fingernails or something like that. And then Juno goes, and this becomes sort of it's the thing that Juno brings up with her friend afterwards, I think, when she's saying why she didn't have the abortion. And also, while she's in the abortion clinic waiting for someone to see her.
She's looking at everyone's fingernails.
Right. The camera pans to all the adult human beings in the room and pans to their fingernails. And I think that's, I don't know, I think... What's interesting?
Well, and the receptionist at the clinic is portrayed as an utter grotesque. I mean, the pro-life protester outside, Sue Yin, I can't remember what her name is.
Something like that.
Is a clown, but she's a sympathetic clown.
Right.
Whereas the receptionist at the abortion clinic is pretty repulsive and says, you know, you fill out this form and make sure to include every score and every sore, and tells her, you know, offers her a boysenberry.
Condom, and
she loves them because they make her boyfriend's junk smell like pie, and
it's a funny movie.
Funny, but appalling. So I certainly don't disagree with you that the portrayal of abortion is a negative one. Again, I think it's a far cry from saying that abortion is a pretty gruesome and ugly process to saying that people shouldn't be allowed to have abortions, and I don't think that this movie comes anywhere near making that leap.
I think, fairly explicitly, in a way,
argues that it needs to be Juno's choice. It is Juno's choice. Juno at first starts to make one choice and then changes her mind and makes the other choice.
Right, although, I mean, she's making... I mean, the movie is in part a brief for nonconformism, and, you know, she makes the nonconformist choice to have the child, and that choice, the nonconformist choice, is the right one. I mean, it's sort of... You know, I feel like it's less a validation of choice in the abstract than this. I don't know. Than this particular choice.
And there is a sense
in which the fingernail scene is, I mean, in a way, closer to a pro-life argument than anything that's presented in Knocked Up. I mean, the argument against abortion in Knocked Up is abortion is gross, and the people who want you to do it are gross. Everybody has fingernails kind of...
Yeah, although a big part of it, I think that everybody has fingernails, that's certainly supposed to be, you know, what impels her to do this. But I think as a viewer, as you're watching it, the real sort of rationale is, boy, this place is gross, and that receptionist with, you know, with the pierced nose and the boysenberry condoms is really gross. And you're right that it makes that argument, but I think it also just, a lot of it is just kind of like, yuck.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't disagree, but I do think
you do not have the sense. At least I certainly don't have the sense seeing that movie that if after hearing about the babies having fingernails and being told, you know, all babies want to be born, if she'd walked into a beautiful, lovely clinic with, you know, with nicely presentable looking clients there and a professional, sympathetic receptionist, I do not, for one, think that she would have left. I think as much as anything else, it was this feeling of it being a kind of dirty, clandestine place where she really didn't want to be, and the fingernail certainly played into it, but it, you'll also notice at the scene in the abortion clinic, it's not just that she focuses on everyone's fingernails, but the other clients are all kind of gross. She's focusing on these fingernails as people are scratching themselves. I mean, the whole scene is sort of portrayed as like...
Right, no, it's a skin... Right, it's a skin-crawling kind of experience.
Right.
But, I mean, there are different ways... I don't know, one of the things... When people tried to, myself included, write that, you know, first Knocked Up and then Juno are, you know, if not political cases against abortion, then moral cases against abortion... I mean, one of the common responses was, well, you know, this is just, it's a plot device. You have to have, you know, if you want to make a movie about an unwed mother, she can't have an abortion. There's no movie otherwise. And I think that's true up to a point, but I think...
Well, I'll address that in a second. I mean, the one thing I just want to repeat again before we move on to this next point is you can think that abortions are ugly or immoral or any number of things and still think they should be legal. Being pro-choice doesn't make you pleased with abortions any more than being pro-life makes you pleased with teen pregnancy. You know, if you're pro-choice, you think that there are occasionally other things that are worse than abortion, teen pregnancy being an obvious example. If you're pro-life, it's different in that, at least politically pro-life, it's different in that you think that
right, but in the
nothing
case of,
almost
in the,
nothing.
In the case of Juno, I mean, it is, you know, the movie's implicit argument is that this particular teen pregnancy, at least, is better than an abortion.
Right, absolutely. This particular, but again, it's obviously an enormously atypical one. She has the most supportive family in the history of the world. The boy who got her pregnant is the sweetest, tenderest, most decent guy you could ever want to be impregnated by, who offers to stand by her in any way. She's not ostracized at school. She doesn't.
Right. Well, no, she is. She is ostracized at school. I mean, I wouldn't go that like she's, you know, the encounters with teachers, the classmates parting around her at school. The judgmental ultrasound technician. I mean, I think there is presented as a cost, certainly.
I'm not so sure that's the case. I mean, she was presented as a nonconformist who people sort of looked at strangely before she even got pregnant. There's that whole scene where the jock is looking at her funny as she's walking down the hallway, and she says, "Ah, but those jocks, they secretly want weird librarian goth girls like me." So I'm not really sure that there was a big difference in kind between the way that she was treated after she was pregnant and the way she was treated before she was pregnant. And certainly, in neither case, there's no horrible scene where, whatever, she's not allowed to go into a party or somebody insults her to her face, or there's none of the sort of humiliation that one would assume would
well, right, although the movie
attend.
Doesn't really present... I mean, I actually thought that was one of the few... I wish the movie had actually done more with that, like, what is sort of her social world?
True. She's a bit of a cipher.
But actually, I mean, this takes us away from Juno a little bit. But what you just said about her, you know, having the most wonderful, supportive boyfriend in the world, and so on. Actually, I mean, it's 6 months old, but maybe we could talk about for a minute the debate over Knocked Up, and not the question of abortion, but there's been this whole back and forth. Catherine Hagel made these comments about you know, how she had a great time filming the movie, but she thought it was really unfair to women and so on. And Megan O'Rourke wrote a piece for Slate about sort of the problem with Knocked Up from a female point of view. And we haven't talked about this, in a non-Vlogging Heads format, so maybe we could talk about it in this format. I was curious what you thought of that critique of Knocked Up.
I think it's enormously valid. I think the fundamental weakness of the movie is that the imbalance between the male and female protagonists, both in terms of how much Apatow focuses on them and seems to understand them and fleshes them out, and to an even greater extent in terms of just how attractive they are, it's really kind of laughable. I mean, we're in Woody Allen territory here. I thought one of the things, I think it's interesting to compare it to The Last American Virgin. I think if you compare the male protagonists, played by Seth Rogen in Knocked Up, and Steve Carell
In the 40-year-old version, right?
In the 40-year-old version. I'm thinking about abortion too much here. Steve Carell is a more appealing character in almost every way. He's not as foul-mouthed. He has an actual job. He doesn't sit around all day getting stoned with his buddies trying to create a celebrity skin site. He's not, whatever, he's not a foul-mouthed reprobate who asks for a blowjob right after a woman tells him that she's gotten pregnant from him. And he's just decently better looking as well, and much sweeter. And the female protagonists have gone in exactly the other direction, where the male protagonist has become somewhat or dramatically less attractive. You've gone from Catherine Keener in the 40-year-old version, whom I adore. I love Catherine Keener. But she's represented as a little offbeat, not any great sort of...
Right, she's older, she has
beauty.
Several kids, yeah.
She's got a peculiar job, and you go from that to Katherine Hagel, who's this blonde bombshell who's suddenly, on-air talent at the local TV show. And
not
just,
the local, it's the national, the Entertainment Television Network.
You remember better than I do. So you have this enormously successful, insanely gorgeous woman going for this just repulsive loser who really brings nothing at all to the table until fairly late in the movie. And I think it's a huge problem. I think it's one of the reasons that the movie, while in some respects excellent and on a number of occasions fairly probing, overall doesn't really work because it is just, you're just so wildly out of whack here. I don't think anyone can really see that relationship and consider it even plausible by Hollywood standards.
Well, and it's interesting because it seems like there are two sort of, I don't know if you want to call them feminist critiques of the movie, but they're interrelated. But one is that Apatow just isn't as good at creating the inner lives of female characters, and the female characters therefore are not as funny as the male characters. That they're sort of alpha women who don't know how to have a good time in a way. Like
sure,
the classic
sure.
the parallel I think O'Rourke's piece draws is between the scene where Seth Rogen and Paul Rudd's characters go to Vegas,
to
Cirque du Soleil and get stoned on shrooms and,
right.
Are sort of, they're cut off from the women and they're having a wild time. And the women go and get turned away from the local club because they're too old. And, they sit on the sidewalk together. And, so there's that disconnect that, women aren't funny, men are funny. The men are sort of freewheeling and the women are uptight and so on. And then there's the disconnect that you were talking about, which is just the Hagel-Rogan disconnect, and not only in the actors, but just sort of their distinct their distinct lives. That the movie, the question isn't really even about abortion. Like it's more plausible that it's more plausible in a way that Hagel's character would keep the child than that she would keep Seth Rogen.
Yes. Oh, I think there's no question. I mean, whatever. She's got two children on her hands, and one is going to be small and adorable and will hopefully cease causing her physical pain within, the span of several months, and the other is this loud, dumb, crude, self-involved pothead who, again, he's fun if you're watching the movie, but the idea that he would be somebody that you would, under any circumstances, consider, wanting to live with or raise a child with, it's, again, up until the very... And it's just laughable. So I guess I'm saying I agree with both of those.
Both of those critiques. Yeah.
I liked the movie. I thought there was a lot in it that was really good. But I think it's clearly the case that Apatow is much more comfortable writing male parts. And particularly, I mean, one thing that you've noticed now in all of these movies that are almost sort of a triptych with the 40-year-old version and
Superbad
and Superbad is that the funniest moments by far in these movies tend to exist almost outside the narrative altogether. The funniest parts in the movies tend to be when the male friends are just sitting around shooting the shit, and nothing's happening, and the plot isn't moving forward, and there are no women present. And I think in all three movies, that's where a bulk, a plurality, perhaps, of the laughs takes place. But those things are almost little pit stops, and then you go back to the regular plot, and Seth Rogen and Katherine Hagel have to decide what they're going to do about their relationship and so forth. But in all three movies...
The only thing I would say, and I completely agree with you, the only thing that might be said, well, this isn't really an Apatow's defense because he did cast her, but Catherine Hagel is not really a good actress.
Yeah,
and
that's certainly
is definitely not a funny actress. And
no, I agree with
even,
that.
Even though the, you know, the other female characters in his movies likewise are not, I think, nearly as well written or interesting as the male characters, I think the two girls in Superbad, anyone played by his wife, Leslie Mann, Catherine Keener's character in The 40-Year-Old Virgin, all these characters fit much better into the Apatow universe than Hagel's character. And some of it is that, you know, she was written as uninteresting, but some of it is that Hagel herself just... I haven't watched that much Grey's Anatomy, but what I've watched hasn't impressed me there, and I thought she wasn't much and Knocked Up, really.
But you can look forward to 27 Dresses next week.
Yes. No, it's true. Her and James Marsden, you know, after playing second banana in all the X-Men movies, gets to finally be a leading man.
Oh, you didn't see Enchanted. He's very good in Enchanted. And he was the unlucky corner of the superhero love triangle in Superman Returns too, wasn't he? I think so.
Yes. No. Right.
He's
cornered the market on
by superheroes
on second bananas in superhero movies. But
exactly.
Let's go back to what we were talking about before, though, the question of whether the idea that the woman choosing not to have an abortion and having a child is just, you know, a necessary plot device to kick the movie off. You wanted to say something about that?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you're certainly right that nobody, you know, they could choose to make a movie that's about something else altogether. But one thing that I do think has been lost a bit in all of the hoopla, the multiple slate pieces, and there was a piece in the New York Times about, you know, is Hollywood turning pro-life after Waitress and Knocked Up came out, is that the unwanted pregnancy movie is not remotely a new development, or even a new development in comedy, and there are numerous, numerous examples of unwanted pregnancy movies in which the woman keeps the baby. And there are fairly obvious reasons for this. I mean, it is a really easy narrative to tell, because an unwanted pregnancy, if you want it to be, is a problem that ultimately fixes itself. So in Saved or in, I know there are a bunch of, The Opposite of Sex, and
Look Who's Talking.
Look Who's Talking. You know, you have this horrible, oh no, it's terrible, it's going to ruin my relationships, it's going to ruin my career. And then the baby's born, and a lot of these movies end, as Juno did, as Knocked Up did, as Waitress did, as The Opposite of Sex did, and Saved did, with the baby's born, and everyone gathers around the bed, and lessons have been learned, everyone discovers the value of love or responsibility or something, but the problem has ceased to be at least the problem that it was, the problem of the pregnancy. And the movies, as a general rule, don't really delve into the ensuing problem, which is the problem of how do we raise this kid and am I a single parent and so forth. Juno gets around that to some degree by having the baby adopted, obviously. But I feel like because I really think a lot of the discussion about this as a big trend is merely an artifact of the fact that Waitress and Knocked Up came out, I think, just a week apart. Not more than a couple weeks, at least. And people suddenly thought, oh, my God, look, they're everywhere. These movies are ubiquitous. And, in fact, it's a pretty common story. And, again, I think a common story for very obvious reasons. It's one that really works. You have this problem, but it's a problem that not only can go away, but can actually turn into a good thing at the end if you want it to be. Now, of course, obviously, most unwanted pregnancies, that's not the way they resolve themselves. But this is Hollywood, and just in sort of film it's a really easy story to tell.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you can argue that a lot of unwanted pregnancies do resolve themselves that way, in the sense that, you know, once, you know, even if the situation itself is bad for a variety of reasons, once you have an existing baby, I think it's hard for people to regard that as anything other than a good thing in a way that's different.
I'm sure that is the case in many cases. I suspect that it is not the case in many other cases. I'm not really in any position at all
how many
women who have unpregnancies that they choose to carry to term in the end are glad that they did, or sorry that they did, or for that matter, how many women who have abortions later wish that they hadn't, or wish that they had. I'm not really in a position to guess how those play out.
Well, wait.
But it is a great deal easier to make a movie about an unwanted pregnancy that resolves happily with a birth than to make a movie about an unwanted pregnancy that resolves happily with an abortion. As I think you see in Fast Times at Ridgemont High, which really that's the sort of the low point of the movie, when Jennifer Jason Leigh has to go and get the abortion, and there's a scene even in the clinic, I think, which may not have been the original cut, but has dribbled out since. I think I mentioned it before when I was thinking of the 40-year-old version of this movie. Also another early 80s teen sex comedy called The Last American Virgin, which doesn't quite end with the abortion, but the abortion is very near the ending, and it sort of goes from that into what is, I think, without doubt, the saddest, most bitter conclusion of any teen sex comedy ever. I mean, it's really a dismal, dismal ending. And,
wow,
and
that sounds. I guess I have to go rent it now or not.
Yeah. It's awful. It's an appalling. You want a movie that makes abortion look not very appealing. That's a movie that makes abortion look not very appealing. I think probably 82 or something. Anyway, but while you're certainly right that nobody's forcing people to go out and make movies about unwanted pregnancies that resolve happily with births, it is a very easy narrative.
That's true.
And the alternative narrative about, you know, trying to make an upbeat comedy about somebody who has an abortion is a very difficult one. It's not impossible.
I completely agree. I do think, though, the only thing that I will say in defense of that Hollywood is being overtaken by pro-lifers argument, which I generally agree is specious, is that there are different ways you can tell a story about a woman choosing to carry a child to term, and you can tell the contemplating abortion part of it in different ways. And I think that the way that I Knocked Up and Juno tell that part of the story is very different than the way, for instance, Sex and the City had a subplot where Miranda, Cynthia Nixon's character, was pregnant out of wedlock and was contemplating an abortion. And as I recall, and I haven't seen it in a few years, but that episode was sort of 20 minutes of essentially pro-choice propaganda where she sat around with all her friends, and the friends were like, oh yeah, we all had abortions and it was the right thing to do and you should feel totally comfortable with this choice. And then at the end of the show, she decided to keep the baby. But the whole show was sort of a validation of abortion as an option
in a way that I don't think either Knocked Up or
Juno really is.
Yeah, I didn't see the show, but that certainly is about what I would have anticipated. I mean, my guess, and I don't want to get too far off the movies here for any number of reasons, including that you know the subject far better than I do. My guess would be that this is less because Hollywood is becoming pro-life than because just the whole abortion debate seems to be cooling in general. It does not seem to me to be an area where there's quite the same sort of fervor on either side that there was 5 or 10 years ago. And I don't know. Insofar as I think a movie like Knocked Up or Juno is making a political comment about abortion, I think it's more of a sort of peace offering than a surrender thing.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think that the debate has cooled. It's certainly cooled since the sort of, you know, the era of abortion clinic shootings and so on. I think it's cooled in part because issues like the Iraq War have sort of, you know, sucked all the oxygen out of a lot of some culture war debates, at least.
That the energy that was going into abortion, you know, 10 or 15 years ago is going into things like gay marriage now.
Is cooling too, but I do think that there has been some cultural shift that both Juno and Knocked Up reflect since Roe v. Wade and since the 70s, where abortion is more frowned upon now, just from a moral point of view, than it was immediately after Roe v. Wade. And I think you can see this in statistics about, you know, the number of doctors asking to be trained as abortionists and so on. I think there is some slight shift in, at least in public opinion. But, you know, I mean, a movie is just a movie.
Again, keeping the subject on movies, partly just because, whatever, I have a little more to say there. I don't doubt that that's the case, but again, I don't think it's been any sea change. I mean, whatever, the abortion in Fast Times at Ridgemont High is not. I don't think the movie ever suggests that it was a mistake to get the abortion, but it certainly is not presented as some just, you know, sort of whatever empowering feminist moment. It's presented as really kind of awful. And certainly, again, this movie, The Last American Virgin, just bitter, awful, tragic conclusion. So I think the degree to which people who are pro-choice are, you know, almost enthusiastic about abortion gets exaggerated frequently, and sometimes because there are certain people who are so concerned about giving ground that they almost seem as though they're enthusiastic about abortion because they're so enthusiastic about abortion rights. Again, I think in general, most people who are pro-choice can view abortion as whatever, you know, something you want to avoid if at all possible, but that it's not always possible to avoid, or in some cases, avoiding it would lead to far worse outcomes than having an abortion.
But if your boyfriend happens to be played by
Michael Cera,
all bets are off.
Gotta keep that genetic material alive
for
comedy in the future.
Before we leave the topic of Juno behind, could you explain for me briefly the dark sexual magic of Michael Cera?
I can't believe that it needs explanation. If you don't get it, it's just one of those things that...
No, my reaction to Michael Cera is actually very similar to my reaction to Arrested Development, which is where he got, you know, where he got his big break, which is to say, I like it, and I like him, and I think they're both funny, and, you know, it's Arrested Development was a funny show, he's a talented actor. I feel like I have a lot of friends who worship the ground Michael Cera walks on, and I'm still trying to figure that out.
You can actually buy that ground online if you're quick.
If you're
people follow behind him, cutting it out of the Earth's crust. I think he's marvelous. There are a number of things. I mean, obviously, he's just very sensitive and likable and an entirely sympathetic comedian. He's a comedian who essentially never indulges in spiteful comedy or aggressive comedy. It's a very meek sort of a passive comedy, but marvelous. The person who he really reminds me of is Bob Newhart in a funny way. I mean, I never saw Bob Newhart until he was, you know, Bob Newhart and a whole lot older than me and have no idea what he even did before the Bob Newhart show. So I don't know if you went that far back into his past, if the parallel would seem to
hold. He started in stand-up. Newhart did, yeah.
Yeah, that's true. And I have actually, kind of thing, I have seen plenty of the stand-up. Although, years and years and years ago. But in any case, it seems to me they both excel at a kind of reactive comedy. I mean, like Michael Cera, Bob Newhart was also always sort of, you know, the eternal victim. He's never a bully. He's never somebody he's also never somebody who has to go very far for a laugh. They're both minimalist comedians as well. And I think they both have this remarkable gift for silence, for finding the humor that is in between the jokes. It's not just that I think Michael Cera can deliver a funny line enormously well, and also quite effectingly in some cases. But he can be extremely funny without saying anything at all. And, of course, this was a big skill of Bob Newhart's. One of his most famous comedic talents was he was, you know, generally considered, I think, the best comedian alive when it came to doing one end of a phone conversation. Which is a little bit what Blogging Heads feels like, frankly, sitting here staring at a camera. Anyway, he was just great at the pauses, you know. In between his lines, there was nobody on the other end of the phone, but he could make you feel that there was someone and could make you just feel the humor in those pauses. And Michael Cera is so good at this. There's one moment early in Juno. It's when they're in science lab, I think, and they've got these two sort of amazingly unappealing science lab partners who I guess are kind of dating but are angry with each other because the amazingly unattractive boy supposedly went to visit his brother at college and maybe cheated on her or something, which seems
pretty implausible, yeah.
That he would ever have sexual opportunity of any kind. But they're talking about some flavor, snow peach flavor of Boone's or something.
And Sarah Juno says, go on, sorry.
Juno sort of sarcastically says, oh, well, I've always heard that snow peach Boone's is the best flavor, right? And she turns to Michael Cera, and he doesn't say anything. He's just got this little sort of half smile, and he sort of cocks his head one way, and then it looks like he's going to say something, and he cocks his head the other way, and he just lets it drop, and it's just a marvelous comic moment. I think it's a very rare gift, particularly in an age like today where so many comedians are, you know, big on having sort of a larger than life persona and always sort of winking, always in on the joke. There are ways in which I think Michael Cera is a little bit like Will Ferrell as well. I think Will Ferrell's great insight in modern comedy
is humorous sincerity.
Right. It's that he is the joke. He's never in on the joke. And in an era, you know, with people like Mike Myers and Adam Sandler, they're always winking. They always, you know, every time they tell a joke, they have to make sure that you realize that they get the joke. They wrote the joke. This is my joke. I get it, of course. And Will Ferrell almost never winks like that. The guy who, I don't know if you've seen him, Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story, but John C. Reilly, who was in Talladega Nights with Will Ferrell, is the first adult comedian who I think has quite, or I mean, he's not even really a comedian, he's a serious actor, but the first person who I think is quite clued into this Will Ferrell thing. He does something very similar in Walk Hard. He just plays it absolutely straight ahead.
Yeah.
You know, he's a likable goofball.
But what's interesting about Sarah is that, I mean, and, you know, again, I missed out on the young Bob Newhart, but he is... I feel like that kind of sincerity is rare in an adolescent or young actor. Yeah, I mean, Ferrell,
sure.
And O'Reilly, Reilly, and not Bill O'Reilly, and Newhart are
all like
sincerity sort of,
too.
You know, they're middle aged figures in a way, and part
sure.
And Sarah, I mean, I was trying to, because Sarah isn't just that he's funny, and it isn't just that he's sort of. And it's not that he just is the joke. Sorry, I'm stuttering
right.
here.
No, that's true.
He also tells the jokes, and I was trying to come up. I mean, in a way, he almost seems like a, you know, less handsome American version of Hugh Grant, in that he has a sort of stammering charm.
Yeah.
I mean, he doesn't, you know, he's American, he's not English, it's a different kind of stammer.
Sure, sure.
I think the
great... What you've nailed there is his great, great talent for self-deprecation.
Right.
In almost any movie, whether Hugh Grant is playing, you know, the sort of likable, you know, romantic figure, or the just sleazy, disgraceful romantic rival, the two roles he tends to find himself in. Regardless, the performances are almost always really self-effacing, at least self-effacing, anywhere from self-effacing to sort of self-indicting.
Well, good. All right. Well, so Michael Cera, we've resolved it. He's Hugh Grant crossed with Bob Newhart with some Will Ferrell thrown in.
Perfect.
So,
it's the perfect comedy machine.
Right. So if we agree that films like Juno and Knocked Up aren't the manifestation of Hollywood chickening out in front of pro-lifers, there is a movie
I mean, I do think it's worth recalling that in the last 10 years, Imelda Staunton was nominated for Best Actress for Vera Drake, which I don't think would have happened in a million years if she was not playing an abortion provider.
Yeah.
And Michael Caine actually won an Oscar in The Cider House Rules for playing an abortion provider, despite
Cider
the fact
House
that I must have seen at least 36 Michael Caine performances, and that's down there with Jaws 4, among the very, very, very worst Michael Caine performances
you
I've ever seen.
You princes of Maine, you kings of New England. No, wait, it's kings of Maine.
Whatever it is. Ugh, I've
really,
been trying
really,
to repress
no,
it ever since.
Really terrible movie. Right, but so we're agreed on that. But there is a movie out this Christmas that does seem like a pretty clear case.
The one thing I should say before this, and I assume this is true of you as well, because we are out in Washington in the hinterlands, I suspect neither one of us has seen the Romanian film 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days, which is about a woman trying to procure an abortion in Romania.
Under Ceausescu's regime, right?
Exactly,
when it was
illegal.
I have not seen it. It's supposed to be amazing.
Yeah, it's supposed to be remarkable, but unfortunately...
Although I do think there is a danger, like where people, you know, people say to you, "This is a film set in Ceausescu's Romania about a woman trying to procure an illegal abortion," where the pressure to say that film is amazing is almost.
Well, I mean, again, it's the sort of Vera Drake and Cider House Rules effect. Perhaps,
but no,
I haven't seen the movie.
We're both provincial film critics, so we haven't seen it, but we have both seen The Golden Compass, which does seem like a case. My colleague Hannah Rosen wrote a very good piece on this in The Atlantic a couple issues ago about it is a case where Hollywood sort of chickens out from a controversial subject in order to avoid offending
True.
Not pro-lifers, but religious people.
Yes, and I think, whatever, I mean, that clearly, I mean, it's pretty well documented. That's a clear case of self-censorship. Now, you can argue whether it's self-censorship that makes sense, whether the books would be better off without the sort of heavy anti-church undercurrents. You're considerably more expert than these books than I am. I should say that I've only read the first book to date, and liked it, didn't love it, have heard from enough people, both people who are happy with the message and unhappy with the political message of the books. I've heard from a lot of people that the third book is an enormous letdown, and so have been slow to.
Well, no, and that's
read the second,
and that's
third books.
What's really unfortunate about the movie is that the director Chris Weitz has basically said, "Look, we went along with things the studio wanted to do in this movie in the hopes that, or not in the hopes, but he says, you know, we're going to be very careful with the succeeding movies now." There probably won't be succeeding movies because the movie's been kind of a flop. But even worse is that, you know, the first book, I think, is easily the best book of the trilogy. So even if he'd been able to go on and make the sequels, he's made the worst film out of the best book. And
sure. Now my take on the movie is I think it was a bad movie. I mean, not terrible, but very disappointing. I don't really think that the ways in which it was bad are in any way connected to the sort of question of censoring the novel of some of its anti-religiosity. But I'm curious, do you think the two are related?
I think it put a weird note into the movie. Like, I mean, I think fantasy movies in general are very hard to pull off. I think as we've seen from all the attempts to sort of capture the same lightning in a bottle that Peter Jackson managed.
Sure, sure.
With Lord of the Rings,
Stardust,
and Aragorn was just terrible. And even Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe was better. It was sort of like good middle brow entertainment, but it still, I don't think, was a complete success.
And I agree with that.
And I think part of what you have to do as a filmmaker, and what Jackson did with Lord of the Rings, I mean, you really have to sort of give yourself completely to the world and the fictional world that you're filming about, and you can't constantly be sort of keeping one foot in that world and one foot in the world of, like, trying to over-explain to the audience what's going on.
That's right.
And I feel like The Golden Compass had that sort of, you know, it felt rushed. It was sort of, you know, there's, like, voiceover at the beginning, and the movie ends with a really clumsy sort of explanation where one of the characters basically is like, all right, this is what's going on. This is the war that we're embarked on, and so on.
Right.
And I think that cutting out the anti-God stuff, or at least toning it down, was part of that, because it made the whole conflict seem much vaguer than it should. Because they kept the idea that, like, there's an evil church, the Magisterium, and, like, that there's this authority who's really God, who's bad. They sort of kept that idea, but without the specifics. I mean, you need Mordor, you know, take Lord of the Rings, you need Mordor, you need Sauron, you need orcs, you need to be very clear, like, who the bad guys are. You can't just be like,
you need Christopher Lee, who apparently some law has been passed that if you're going to have an evil wizard-like figure, you must cast Christopher Lee or else go elsewhere for financing.
Right, and he's in the movie he's in The Golden Compass for, like, literally 47 seconds.
I know, that's the hilarious thing. You've got Count Dooku and Saruman here, and they don't even use him. I think I completely agree with what you thought was lacking in the movie. I found it flabbergasting that you could make this movie. I mean, as a general rule, if a movie can have me headed for the exits in under 2 hours, I think that's a great thing. I think an enormous number of movies are much, much longer than they should be. I think that filmmakers sort of get this sense of themselves that they're too important to make movies that are less than 2 hours long. But of all the movies that needed to be, you know,
right.
2 hours 15, 2.5, maybe even, you know, pushing closer to 3. Like, that's what this is. It's an epic. It's supposed to inherit the mantle of Lord of the Rings. And it clocked in at, like, an hour and 45 minutes. And just from the beginning felt totally rushed. I had this
jumping
from here
one.
She is at Jordan College. Now here she is on a ship. Now here she is, you know, up in this sort of Scandinavian fishing town. You know, now here she is at this prison. But there was very little sense of sort of forward motion, either geographically or narratively or in time. I had trouble telling how much time was supposed to have elapsed, between her arriving at Mrs. Coulter's house and her leaving. It just felt almost utterly devoid of connective tissue. If you basically had been told, you need to make this movie in an hour and 45 minutes or less, film only the scenes that are absolutely necessary for the narrative, I feel like you would have ended up with something very similar to this movie, which just, I felt like it's really only toward the end that you're starting to feel comfortable with this alternative universe
right.
that they've created, and you're just starting to settle in and sort of say, like, okay, I have some vague sense of, this world with flying witches and talking warrior polar bears and this weird Texan aeronaut and everything. You're just starting to feel like you're in place, and the lights come up and you're leaving.
Yeah, no, I agree. New York Magazine, their culture blog, Vulture, they actually went...
Which is marvelous.
It's a fantastic, fantastic site, but they went and got both... Tom Stoppard wrote a draft of the screenplay, wasn't used. They got that, they got Weitz's original draft, and they said that the Stoppard draft was actually too long and sort of right. over the top and verbose and so on, but that Weitz's original draft felt like a really good 3-hour movie. And presumably, this is just a question of the studio saying, no, we want a 2-hour movie, so...
Right, we want to be able to show it, we want that one extra screening every Saturday
right.
night.
And they got there, and the movie contains all the special effects shots that you could want, but it's just what you said. I've never seen a movie that had so many establishing shots and
right.
so little happening after each establishing shot.
That's exactly right. It was a little like the third X-Men movie. Had that same, a similar problem, in addition to many,
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 to many,
other
many other problems.
Terrible, 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 terrible movie.
The third X-Men movie, I would say, was, if The Golden Compass was, like, a good 3-hour movie cut down to a 2-hour movie, the third X-Men movie was, like, a really great trailer, and it was like, they filmed the trailer, and then they're like, all right, now we gotta stick some stuff in between the...
No, the third X-Men movie, I think, is the only movie I've ever seen where watching the movie actually was... would have been less preferable to just sitting down and reading the script. It was the worst, just utter film script I've ever seen. And just every line reading felt false. Every moment there was no silence. There were no time for anybody to respond to anything. It's killing off these supposedly beloved characters every 5 minutes, and you don't even have time to care.
Anyway, yeah,
it's a little far afield.
Well, but so. Let's switch gears to another movie that you hated, maybe not as much as the third X-Men, but that Into the Wild, Sean Penn's Into the Wild.
Right. Now you sort of liked this movie in spite of yourself, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, the movie is, you have this, it's the story of Christopher McCandless, this kid who, runs away from home and, becomes a tramp roaming America and basically is... a wannabe New Age poet who's kind of an idiot and gets in way over his head and dies in the Alaskan wilderness. And the question is, how seriously do you take him and how much do you treat him just as, kind of a creep who, made his parents really unhappy by disappearing and then dying?
Well, or even to what extent do you try to understand how those two interpretations can exist side by side? I mean, I think on some level, those are both not just valid interpretations, but sort of literally true of the guy. I mean, there is a lot about him that's fairly impressive. There's a lot about him that's also just really sort of, lame and stupid and selfish. And what drove me nuts about the movie is it just made no effort. Well, I mean, I guess it didn't make any effort to see how the two halves fit together because it basically pretended the second half didn't even exist. It's infuriated is a little strong, but not by much. It really, really irritated me because it had the form of a sort of thoughtful inquiry. That's what it's supposed to be. He's going out into the wild, but we're going into his world.
Right.
We're supposed to learn what it is that drives him, what made him tick. And I feel like it has none of the content that would require. It's an amazingly thoughtless movie. I'm thoughtless just in the sense of it just doesn't contain any ideas at all, or rather it contains one idea that it just says over and over and over and over and over again, and that Sean Penn just underlines in the most ham-fisted ways possible with a terrible, terrible voiceover by Jenna Malone, who plays who plays the sister, and just really obvious shots left and right and some really hokey dialogue. And whatever, the best explanation we ever get for why he did what he did is the explanation that McCandless offers himself, which is this just unbelievably sophomoric. You know, he did it for truth. He did it for freedom. And the movie doesn't even make any effort to unpack what those really mean. I mean, it's like a political campaign. I just felt like the movie basically had all of the depth of, you know, of a Mitt Romney campaign ad. I mean, there's just nothing there. It's all surface.
I thought the lead performance was superficial. I half agree with you. I mean, I think clearly the movie is naive, and it takes the first half of his persona, the sort of young, mystic, visionary quester, much more seriously than it should. However, it can't help, you know, I mean, even with the way Sean Penn told the story, the movie still does end, spoiler alert, but like the big epiphany that he gets from going into the wild is that going into the wild isn't really the right thing to do, and that, like, you know, you need, you know, the movie ends with, like, before he dies, like, underlining or writing letters, or I forget exactly, about, like, the importance of human companionship. And I don't know. I mean, I think there are elements in the movie that undermine his heroic narrative. I think his interactions with Hal Holbrook's character, who, this old man who befriends him, who gives a really great performance. Even some of his interactions with the hippie couple he meets along the way. I think you do, maybe in spite of what Sean Penn was trying to do, you do get the sense of sort of the casual violence that this kind of person does to the lives of people who care about them. I think there was more of that than you're giving the movie credit for.
Well, I think there was, I think, whatever, I would agree with you, it crept in around the edges. I probably think there was less of it than you think there was. But what I found immensely irritating was that I thought it was almost all accidental. I don't think Sean Penn was trying to bring it in around the edges. I felt like it crept in there despite his best efforts to expunge it from the story. I felt like the movie was always on McCandless' side, even when he was sort of getting the worst of an argument or looking like a jerk. The movie never sort of took Holbrook's side in any of these questions. And it always just sort of felt like, well, he's right and McCandless is wrong, and or at least he's, you know, largely right and McCandless is largely wrong. And why is Sean Penn too foolish to see this? I thought it was a movie that was so superficial. And that would be fine if it was a movie that was intended to be superficial. But it's a movie that sort of pitches itself as this deep, you know, intellectual, philosophical inquiry into the nature of man and the nature of nature and the nature of society and the nature of isolation, and then just doesn't have anything to say about any of that. It was just so empty. I mean, there's a lot of beautiful nature photography in it, obviously, but I just thought that was about it. And whatever, you know, the obvious comparison, and I'm surprised it's not invoked by more people. I'm sure it was invoked by plenty. Is to Grizzly Man, the great documentary from a couple of years ago by Werner Herzog about Timothy Treadwell, and that's made with actual footage of Timothy Treadwell, this guy who, you know, very, very similar story, troubled guy, unlike McCandless, had lots of drug problems and so forth, went into the wilds of Alaska, lived, you know, in some cases virtually face-to-face with grizzly bears every summer for, I don't know what it was, about a dozen years, and was eventually killed and eaten by one. On some level, I don't understand how you can even make a movie like Into the Wild after a movie like Grizzly Man has come out. It has so much more depth. It's so much more complicated. I mean, Werner Herzog doesn't merely engage, you know, with the question of sort of does.
Grizzly Man. Yeah, it's treated as the film is essentially a long-running argument between Herzog and Treadwell.
Right, that's
that Herzog
exactly right.
creates using the video footage Treadwell left behind, with Herzog taking the side of sanity, the side of civilization, you know, and sort of you know, you have the contrast between Treadwell will say, you know, he'll talk about everything that he sees in the eyes of the bears, and then you'll have Herzog saying, you know, in his German accent, I look into the bears and I see the pitilessness of nature.
Oh, no, his actual line is something, it's even worse than that. I look at the world and I see nothing but chaos, indifference, and murder.
And murder.
Not even
yeah.
death, but murder.
Yeah. No, and look, Gris... I'm not going to defend Into the Wild as a work of art on anything like the scale of Grizzly Man. I would just say, I mean, what is, you know, it is not a deep movie. It's not a searching philosophical inquiry of any kind. It is, as a story, I think, a tremendously interesting story, just the narrative of what this guy did and, you know, where he went and so on, like the extent to which he really did drop out of civilized society, the extent to which he really did do ridiculously reckless things like, you know, taking a canoe all the way down the Colorado River and all this stuff. And I think that, yeah, the only way to enjoy Into the Wild...
It's enjoyed as ecotourism.
Yeah, well, or right, enjoy it as a narrative of somebody who did things that very few people do.
Sure,
and
sure,
to set
although,
aside,
you know,
yeah, to sort of see, and with some pretty nature photography thrown in, yeah, and to seal off your intellectual faculties. I think I just, you know, I'm better at sealing off my intellectual faculties than you are.
Oh, well, clearly, I mean, it's...
we're running out of time, but we did want to talk about, quickly, There Will Be Blood.
Yes, let's talk, and maybe in the context of No Country for Old Men, or...
Well, yeah, I mean, There Will Be Blood, you know, is both... There Will Be Blood and No Country for Old Men are both sort of variations on, you know... Well, they're westerns, they're sort of movies about certain American archetypes and so on. They've together, I think, gotten easily the best reviews of any movies this year.
Maybe with The Diving Bell and The Butterfly thrown in there.
Right, yeah, of any American movies this year, how about that?
Yeah.
And they're both
are sort of philosophical inquiries into the problem with a pitiless universe. I mean, they're both.
Yeah,
they're
no,
both
no. Well, they're everything Into the Wild isn't, but in different ways. I mean, what's interesting to me, I dramatically prefer No Country for Old Men to There Will Be Blood, and I think that's a minority opinion among critics, you know, just based on sort of a glancing reading of the reviews. And
sure,
I think that No Country for Old Men struck me as a much more finished film than There Will Be Blood, that it had what is, you know, can be the Coen brothers' weakness, their sort of their over-precision, their over sort of attention to detail in a way. But I think in the case of No Country for Old Men, it worked as an organic whole in a way a lot of their movies don't always do that. Whereas There Will Be Blood felt like there were sections of There Will Be Blood that were crazier and wilder and better than anything in No Country for Old Men. But
the first 20 minutes of There Will Be Blood is really just breathtaking.
Riveting and fantastic. But I thought that it ultimately was, I don't know, I thought it was less successful as a coherent work.
I entirely agree with you, and like you, preferred No Country for Old Men. I think they're both marvelous movies, and anyone who has the opportunity to should rush out and see both of them. They're really terrific. But I agree. I thought No Country for Old Men felt not just finished, but very close to perfect. There are some complaints about some elements of the ending. There's a little uncertainty there's a scene where it appears that the villain is in a motel room, but when one of the protagonists goes in, he's not there, and there's some debate about whether that's because he wasn't there in the first place or because he really is supposed to be some kind of ghost who can vanish or what it might mean. And personally, I don't mind that ambiguity. And a lot of people didn't like the very end of the movie too. It ends on a very unusual note with the recitation of a dream, Tommy Lee Jones is telling about this dream he had about death. And then the very last words of the movie are, and then I woke up. And I think as a general rule, a movie that ends with the words, and then I woke up, it's probably not a good thing. But I actually think it works pretty well. It did throw me the first time I saw it, but I did have a chance to see the movie a second time. And the second time, it actually worked very well for me. I was I was not, one of the reasons I wanted to see it a second time is it's just such an unexpected ending that it's a little, whatever, it's a little difficult to be ready for if you
well, and I mean, I would say, and No Country for Old Men, the ending strikes me as ambiguous, whereas the ending to There Will Be Blood, and again, spoiler alert, just strikes me as sort of flat-out unsuccessful. Like, you can argue about the ending to No Country for Old Men, and, you know, it's open to multiple interpretations, but the ending of There Will Be Blood, and obviously there are lots of people who defend it, but it's this sort of over-the-top section of the movie that feels, to me, completely disconnected from what's been going on before.
That's right. No, I think you and I disagree slightly. I'm not even sure disagree. I absolutely hated the very last scene. I think it comes very close to ruining the movie. This is a movie that could easily have been my favorite movie of the year, but when I did a top 10 list, basically the ending of it knocked it down to number 5, right behind Juno, and I thought No Country for Old Men was the best movie of the year, and it was particularly infuriating just because There Will Be Blood was such a good movie for the vast majority of its runtime. Now, as I understand it, you think basically there's a whole final act that consists of 2 or 3 scenes where the movie has jumped forward about
15
years, 16 maybe something.
Years,
something like that. And I agree with you that whole thing felt a little rushed, and it went from a moment, the moment right before that point, is a moment at which Daniel Plainview has been sort of humiliated and baptized and forcibly, and it's a fraudulent baptism that's just intended by this priest who wants to demonstrate power over him. But there's this moment when you think that despite the baptism itself having been sort of an act of dominance and fraudulent, he might be redeemed nonetheless. His son, whom he'd sent away, has come back. And his son starts hitting him, his young son, probably 8 years old, 10 years old, something like that, starts hitting him, and he just takes it in stride, and obviously, if you've seen the movie, you'll know all this, and if you haven't, you're probably completely lost already, but Daniel Plainview is not someone that you would casually hit as a general rule. He has a rather violent temper. But he's very tender with the boy and sort of says, now that's enough, and you almost think that there's a moment there where he may actually be, you know, somewhat accidentally redeemed by this, the one business proposition that was, you know, driving him absolutely crazy has been resolved in his favor. He's got this pipeline that allows him to sort of declare victory over Union Oil. And it's a moment at which it seems quite conceivable that the movie could actually have a redemptive ending for Daniel Plainview. And then it goes to this coda, and I'm sort of saying what I think you think, and you should obviously correct me and amend it. And then in the coda, suddenly there's just no hope for redemption whatsoever. We have a couple of scenes in a row which are very bleak, very dismal, and it does sort of feel like we've missed something in going from this moment of, you know, perhaps false hope, but this moment that at least as the seeds of hope and potential redemption to this just completely dire, dismal, there's nothing that can do, this man is a monster without a soul, sort of coda of the last couple scenes.
It felt to me like if it were a Shakespeare play, it's missing like the second half of Act 4 and the first half of Act 5.
The
movie is almost all rising action, and that, you know, it's the story of Daniel Plainview's soul and how his soul ends up, and it's a story of damnation in a sense, but the movie doesn't carry us through that, you know, and it's a very leisurely movie, I mean, which is part of its strength, that it's sort of slow and patient and careful and allows sort of, you know, the camera to roam and the scenes to unspool slowly, and then the lurch forward to Plainview's interactions, first with his son, who's grown up, and then with his great rival, this preacher played by Paul Dano, they felt both different in tone from the preceding scenes and disconnected from them.
I agree. Disconnected philosophically. I mean, the state of Daniel's soul is sort of unresolved in the previous scene, and
right,
it's just completely and emphatically resolved in those later scenes, and it's not quite clear why he has once again, apart from just this sort of catch-all explanation that he's got this this demon of competition inside him. It's not quite whatever. I agree. It doesn't feel organic. Now, I think I objected to that. I completely agree with that diagnosis. I objected to the jump a little less than you, and I thought the scene with the son worked reasonably well. I didn't think it was great, but had the movie ended shortly after that, had it ended, you know, in a sort of quiet moment, you know, had it ended more like, you know, a Citizen Kane ending or the ending of The Godfather or something, with Daniel Plainview having just cut himself off from his son and from his last real contact with the outside world, had it ended with him alone and damned and with no possibility of redemption in his huge new mansion, I guess not new by that point, presumably, I don't think it would have been an ideal ending, but I think it would have been a reasonable ending. It's the very last scene with the preacher played by Paul Dano, a guy named Eli Sunday, that I thought was just a disaster. I thought it was laughable. I thought it was implausible. I thought it took a sort of thoughtful, ruminative movie that should have ended in sort of a minor key and just whipped it up into a sort of absurd theatrical frenzy. I thought that was probably the worst concluding scene of a really, really potentially great movie that I've ever seen. I was devastated by it. I thought it was a terrible, terrible scene on many levels. I mean, first off, I think this is not the story of two men. This is the story of one man, Daniel Plainview. And his primary struggle is not with this preacher, Eli Sunday, it's with himself. But by having a confrontation between these two men be the end, I think it just gives too much weight to Sunday's character. I think it plays into the sort of there's a political reading of the movie, which I think is valid, which is, you know, that this is about domesticating the frontier, and Eli Sunday represents religion, and Daniel Plainview represents
right, it's God and mammon, and right,
all of that stuff, and there's no question that's one of the major themes of the movie, but I don't think it's one of the particularly interesting ones, and certainly the way it's resolved, which is just, you know, whatever, big business humiliates religion and crushes it, is not just whatever, not a terribly interesting or thoughtful ending to my mind. I think the more interesting elements of the movie, again, are about Daniel himself and the sort of spiritual reading of the film, or psychological reading of the film, or what have you, but just about, you know, what has happened to Daniel Plainview. What is, you know, how did he become this soulless monster? What does it mean? And I feel like that scene, partly by elevating Eli, partly by just becoming this just sort of furious, over the top ranting. I mean, Daniel Day-Lewis, who, for those of you who haven't seen the movie, is every bit as remarkable as people are saying he is. It's really just astonishing. He ought to win the Best Actor Oscar by universal acclaim, and I think he will probably come pretty close. It just takes this amazingly interesting, sophisticated character and just turns it into a big, you know, shrieking, over-the-top, you know, he's Hannibal Lecter in the closing moments of the movie, and it's just a terrible shame, I think.
Yeah, well, no, I completely agree, and I have much more to say, but unfortunately I have to call us quits, Chris. But it's been a pleasure chatting with you, and...
It has, I enjoyed it.
And hopefully we'll get to do it again soon.
Good. I hope so. Yeah, we can take this up again sometime soon, and I can offer my comparison to Magnolia.
Sounds good.
Which I think ends similarly. Well, great. Well, thanks a lot, Ross, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
Absolutely. Talk to you soon, Chris.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.